It's The Wonky Show. We're talking graduate outcomes, big changes afoot in Australia, a new report on PhDs, and more. It's all coming up.
Of all the countries in the world, I don't think there's any country that has more similarities in higher education with the UK, particularly England, than Australia. And sometimes what happens in Australia goes on to happen here. So it's really important that we look closely at this. But it's also part of a debate they've been having for a very long time in Australia about what exactly you should take into account.
Welcome to The Wonky Show, your direct way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm Wonky's Editor-in-Chief, Mark Leach, recording from home in lockdown. And joining me to help us hold back the rising tide of higher education policy this week, we have three guests in Cambridge. It's Ellen Wilson, Vice President of Higher Education Services at Pearson. Ellen, your highlight of the week, please.
Well, you only have to look outside, really. The weather and managing to blow up my children's paddling pool without bursting a hole in it this week, which was a big achievement. And also looking forward to the Glastonbury weekend.
You and parents up and down the country.
In North London, it's Wonky's editor, Debbie McVitie. Your highlight of the week, please, Debbie.
My highlight came just 5 minutes ago, when it turns out that my dad has discovered the new app that can let you look at understand what you would look like if you were a different gender, and has just sent himself a picture of just sent me a picture of himself as a woman, and basically it just looks like a picture of me in 30 years' time.
And in Buckinghamshire, we have Nick Hillman, director of HEPI. Nick, your highlight of the week, please.
Yes, well, my personal highlight of the week has been continuing to explore the beautiful countryside near where I live, and I found the most amazing field of red poppies, which apparently is a bad thing, because apparently it means the main crop has failed, but it looked stunningly beautiful.
Right, we start the week with the ongoing release of HESA's graduate outcome statistics. Ellen, what stood out for you in all of this?
Yeah, so it's been really interesting to see. As you say, it's a new survey, not yet complete. The data's being released, and I know we can't necessarily make comparisons to previous surveys like the Delhi, but nonetheless, I think the points that have stood out for me is that it's another source of valuable information at the moment, shining a light on important issues around value and inclusion. So kind of three of the key headlines from it that stood out to me were, first of all, that men earning 10% more than women 15 months after graduating. I was surprised, actually, and quite disheartened that it seems to show that the gap starts at graduate level. I think this needs delving into further. You know, why is it? Are women simply choosing to do jobs that are lower paid than men? If so, why? Are they actually getting paid less for doing the same? And it kind of puts paid to the argument before, which was more around, you know, the gender pay gap due to women having career breaks. But this data doesn't seem to really support this. So I think it's an important one to look at. And I think it probably goes back to looking at the need to do more to smash career stereotypes even earlier in school as well. So I think it might be to do with, you know, the range of degrees women and men choose to study. So that one. And the other two points for me also, again, the graduate outcomes for Black students. Only half of Black university graduates were in full-time employment more than a year after they left, I think, compared to 60% of white students. And only 3% of white graduates were unemployed 15 months after finishing, whereas twice as many Black graduates were, at 6%. And lastly, I think the really interesting angle on this survey is the more contextual questions included, and looking about whether graduates find their current activity meaningful, and looking at things around progress to future goals and, I believe, personal well-being, although I don't think that the data on well-being is released yet. But I thought there've been some good points made in the analysis of this, and looking at the article, I think David Kernan's article on Wonky did raise some interesting questions around, you know, personal fulfillment versus salary, what we value as a society. And I think it's interesting because actually the occupational classifications as well being used, I think, in the survey, putting occupations into high skilled, medium skilled, low skilled is sometimes unhelpful. And, you know, as a country, we need to look at, so if carers are, you know, in the low skilled bracket, or administrative roles, medium skilled, I reckon there are a lot of PAs out there that could give their managers a run for their money. So it's just how we classify roles. And I guess just lastly, I'd say it was more positive, actually, than I was expecting at this point, just in terms of, I think it was 86% of graduates reported that their current activity was meaningful. 72% were using what they'd learnt of their studies in their current activity, which contrasts with what we often hear from the employer view, saying that graduates don't have the skill sets they're looking for. But according to these statistics, you know, it's not stopping them from employing them. But I do say that against this backdrop of obviously where we are at the moment in a pandemic, and the picture is, of course, far much bleaker for recent graduates to come.
How well, Nick, how well do you think the kind of the context of some of these variations are understood by prospective students when you kind of feed this kind of data into thinking about, you know, where you're going to go?
Well, I think it matters to some students and matters much less to others. I mean, we do know that most people who go to higher education do have a career insight. You know, they're going to university because they want to get a fulfilling career at the end. But many others go just because they love, you know, they love their subject. And it is a fascinating data set. You know, some of the things that stood out for me were some other challenges around disabled students, and also the cliff edge between getting a first or a 2-1 and a lower class of degree and what that can mean for employment. I was amused by the piece in one of the newspapers looking at Gavin Williamson's alma mater and trying to say that the unemployment rate from the University of Bradford was higher than Russell Group universities, ignoring, of course, the different type of students with different backgrounds who go to those institutions. But of course, I actually think it showed the opposite. You know, the fact that Gavin Williamson's become the Secretary of State in the Cabinet, having been to the University of Bradford, actually reflects rather well on the University of Bradford. The other thing I would say, because I don't think it's all positive. I mean, it's great that HESA has put this information in the public domain. It's great that, as Charlie Ball said on Wonky, we have a really good baseline by which we can measure later waves of the data affected by the pandemic against. But I mean, we ran a piece by some people at the University of Portsmouth who were saying that the data set massively overestimated the proportion of their graduates who are unemployed. They said 20% of their graduates who look unemployed in the data set were actually registered as full-time postgraduate students at the University of Portsmouth. So I think there are some technical questions we need to go on asking about the data, because this data set really, really matters, because government policy could be set according to it in the future.
I mean, you know, that is sort of understatement of the century. I mean, it seems to me that all of government policy over the last few years has been heading towards that kind of, you know, outcomes based framework for you know, the kind of the economic model underpinning the sector. I mean, we're going to talk about Australia a bit later, but that's, you know, it looks like they're just kind of a couple of steps further down the line. I mean, Debbie, do you see this as becoming more important?
I think what becomes interesting is about where this data gets situated in the in the panoply of data options. So the government's got LEO, which gives us salary data, and now we've got graduate outcomes. They're not directly comparable, but I suppose there could be an element of kind of triangulation to try and understand the kind of, I guess, nuance and richness of the postgraduate experience, if you can call it that. So yes, I think, you know, it is almost certain that, you know, over time we will see the graduate outcomes feature in things like TEF, because it is the replacement for Delhi, and Delhi was in TEF. So yes, I think, you know, it's very much part of that picture. And I guess what we need to sort of hope is that it is done with the requisite level of kind of nuance and thought. So Nick mentioned kind of demographics as being a key influencer of graduate outcomes. And of course, Delhi was very robustly benchmarked to take account of that, so that universities could by and large assess their performance against other universities with similar demographic profiles. And of course, demographic profile isn't the only influencer, but you know, it's a very significant one. So, you know, if we're able, as the data kind of series builds up and as we're able to kind of understand what that benchmarking would look like, then yeah, it'll be very much a feature of policy for years to come, I imagine.
Right, let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hello, I'm Levi Pay. I'm director of the training and consultancy company Plinth House, which works with universities to enhance the way we support students and enhance the way we respond to some of the challenges that we're seeing around student mental health. The government, OFS and the Higher Education Funding Council for Wales recently announced a £3 million investment in the development of a brand new platform called Student Space, which it's intended will exist from July to December to support student mental health during this pandemic. In my article for Wonky, I set out some of my main concerns about this initiative, particularly linked to the very short lead time that we have to produce this new platform, but also around duplication. There are already a lot of existing self-help resources for students to use in this area of student mental health, some of which universities have spent a lot of time and money on producing and purchasing. But I have a particular concern as well around the management of clinical risk. Whenever I hear that there's a new service or a new platform in town that's purporting to deliver therapeutic interventions directly to students, my heckles go up slightly, like they do on the back of our border collie when she spies next door's cat in the yard, because I start to think, hold on, if I was a director of student services now, I would be looking at this emerging new platform and thinking, but how does that fit with our offer and what we do? And how will it respond to the high-risk students? What if a student discloses a high level of risk on this new platform? How will student-based communicate that effectively with university support services, with local NHS teams, and so on? The other key point I make in the article relates to the project that I would like to see in an ideal world. And it's actually a project that's probably a lot smaller and a lot less expensive than the project they've just announced. I would love to see a project which gave a very clear national steer to universities on what an effective and efficient university counselling service should look like today. So how can we make sure that we remodel our counselling teams within universities so that they are better able to respond to the very high levels of demand that we're seeing from students for mental health support and respond to the much higher levels of risk that students are now presenting with?
Right, in a slightly different format, I'm going to ask Debbie to help us gently skim over some of the shallower waters, the koi pond of HE policy, if you will. So Debbie, tell us what you saw bubble to the surface this week.
Okay, well, first thing that caught my eye this week was the announcement that EU students, or students coming to study in the UK from the EU countries, will not be eligible for student loan finance from the academic year 21-22, so not the coming academic year, but the year after. And although I think this was widely expected, and certainly Nick's mentioned in his statement that it would sort of be rather unreasonable once we've left the EU for EU students to be eligible for home fees on a sort of differential basis from international students. I think there may also be some people who were rather disappointed and were holding out hope that something could have been negotiated as part of our exit deal.
Yeah, it's a sort of emotional moment for the sector, isn't it? The cold hard reality of Brexit has finally arrived. It's pretty sad.
Yeah, I think it's probably really bringing home, and I mean we've seen some evidence of that in the firm acceptance statistics that UCAS released just this morning, which is an unusual thing for UCAS to do, to release information about firm acceptances. And though the overall picture is actually quite positive, in that there's more more students holding firm offers than this time last year, and particularly more from the international non-EU cohort, the EU group has declined by six percent, which may be a sort of sign of things to come. The other big news potentially worth noting is that Michael Barber, the chair of the Office for Students, has announced that he will be stepping down from next year, having served his first term as chair, and he will not be seeking a second term, and he will be sort of moving on to brighter and better things.
The press release has made me slightly chuckle. It's sort of, he's moving into the cloud. He's moving into sort of another plane of digital existence.
Yes, when you the first time you read it sort of sounds like Michael Barber himself is taking on is gone fully digital, and he will only be present in holographic form. Actually, what that's referring to is the OFS. Gavin Williamson has asked that OFS before Michael Barber departs his chair, which will be in March 21, so it's still quite a way to go, that OFS undertake an investigation of how universities could enhance the quality of their digital offering. How the sector could be more innovative in developing digital and online provision. So although, yes, the implication is that Michael Barber is going fully digital, actually I think that they're talking about online learning.
It remains the original self-facilitating media node. And there's a new acronym.
Oh yeah. We're all throwing shapes going forward. And I think we might pick this up a little bit later when we talk about the situation in Australia. But there's a new campaign launched this week, which we covered in our Monday, which It involved, you know, lots and lots of illustrious organisations, particularly the British Academy, but you know, others as well, and David Willetts is involved. And it's thinking about how we can articulate better the importance of social sciences, arts and humanities. And they've come up with this acronym SHAPE, which stands for, if I get this right, Social Sciences, Humanities and Arts for People and the Economy. So it's about sort of saying these subjects are not, you know, should not be undervalued. They need to be understood as really contributing to what makes us human and understanding ourselves as human beings. I mean, many subjects contribute positively to the economy, but these are the subjects that, you know, arguably make life worth living. And so that campaign is, I think, a response to some of the narratives about low-value subjects and attempt to kind of preempt perhaps some of the policies that may be emerging in the next 6 months in that space.
Tinsy bit of cynicism I saw on the social.
Well, I think because I suppose the idea that just by putting an acronym in place, you know, sort of saying, ah, well, STEM has an acronym and that's why they're so successful at you know, at winning the attention of policymakers, I don't think that's really what's going on, you know, and that what, you know, what is just needed is a kind of counter acronym, and so I think that's where the cynicism is coming from, because if that were the whole scope of the campaign, that would be rather silly. But it, you know, but it is very much more than that, and it's something that, you know, I think is understood that's going to be developing and you know, emerging over a period of months and years. So it really is not just about the acronym, and I think it's worth watching that space to see what happens more next.
Now, the Australian government has announced widespread reform to the higher education system down under. Debbie, talk us through it.
Right. So, not being the most expert in higher education in Australia, I would absolutely refer readers to an excellent blog on this by Ant Bagshaw, formerly of this parish, who is now based in Australia. But to summarise, so the Australian government has announced what they're calling a Jobs Ready Graduates Package. And this is a follow-up to an announcement made quite recently, in which the government announced that they're aspiring to make Australia a world leader in micro-credentials. So this is a kind of pivot, I guess, in the kind of thrust of higher education policy in Australia, partly prompted by COVID-19, I think, but partly sort of as a part of larger forces. In Australia, they have an income contingent loan system for students, and the balance of what students pay and what government pay is set according to something similar to the old kind of hefty funding bands. So some subjects attract a certain amount of government funding and a certain amount of student contribution, depending on things like the cost of the subject. And what the government's essentially done is reorganised those funding bands, and with the stated intention of better reflecting the cost of delivery, but particularly controversially, to incentivise students into specific courses. So what they've done is they've reduced the student contribution in subjects like science, health, engineering, education and nursing. And they have increased the student contributions for new students in who are studying arts, society and culture, law, creative arts and communications, and those sorts of subjects. So it's a very clear signal, I think, from the Australian government about which sorts of subjects are valued and which sorts of subjects they'd like to see more students taking. A key kind of sting in the tail for universities is that the total funding envelope per university is capped. So universities are getting no more additional funding, and they can't sort of expand you know, particular courses to kind of to go beyond that envelope, but they can reorganise their courses, and, you know, for undergraduate, postgraduate and the different subject banding areas within that funding envelope. It's also worth noting, Australia, like the UK, is expecting demographic growth in the 18 to 19-year-old cohort. And part of this package is about planning for nearly 40,000 extra students in the next couple of years, but again, with no more money. So it's about, it's sort of suggested that the kind of a slight increase in student contributions will basically kind of account for those extra numbers and the funding. So universities are very much being asked to do more with less, really, in kind of as part of this package. And there's also some efforts to improve participation in the regions of Australia, the more rural regions, and support Indigenous populations to access university. So if you're thinking that all of this very much has the flavour of Augur, you'd be absolutely right. And I think this sort of tells us something about the way that education policy trends are not always just specific to one country. You might see sort of different in local flavours of implementation. But the shift to kind of, I guess, to training, to emphasising job readiness, to courses that are of high value to the economy, and to asking universities to be as efficient as possible within a sort of fixed funding envelope, I think we're going to see some of that in our own context very shortly. And we'll all be looking closely at Australia to see how all this pans out. The other thing, a question in other people's minds, of course, is will it actually incentivise students to make different choices? And I think many people will be quite sceptical because, of course, if you're a student, you know, if you're the sort of student who wants to be an artist, you're probably not going to then decide to be an engineer instead on the basis of the cost of your degree. So I don't know whether students in general will have a real problem with this model.
Yeah, well, I think Debbie makes a really important point there, but if you have an income contingent loan, and if your choice of course is restricted both by your interests and also your school leaving exams, what subjects they're in and how well you did in them, there's not quite as much student choice as sometimes policymakers pretend. I mean, I'm really glad that you're covering this story on The Wonky Show today, because of all the countries in the world, I don't think there's any country that has more similarities in higher education with the UK, and particularly England, than Australia. And sometimes what happens in Australia goes on to happen here. So it's really important that we look closely at this. But it's also part of a debate they've been having for a very long time in Australia about what exactly you should take into account when you set differential fees. Because sometimes people think, you know, you can just move from a fixed fee system to a differential fee system. And some people think we in England should do that. And indeed in the other parts of the UK. But there's been a massive debate for years in Australia as to whether what matters is the cost of the provision, the cost of the teaching and the learning, whether it's the labour market outcomes that we were talking about before that matters, whether it's political priorities that matter. And when we looked at this in relation to the UK, we found that almost everybody here who's argued for differential fees has actually meant something very different by it. Some people want, you know, lower fees for things like medicine. Some people want higher fees for things like medicine because they cost more to teach. Some people want lower fees for students from tougher backgrounds. Some people want higher fees for things like history because they think it has less social value, though I don't as a history graduate. And we also found when we did some polling on differential fees that 2/3 of students are opposed to the idea. And I think it also is intriguing that both the Deering report and the Auger report actually came out against having fixed different fee caps for different subjects. So I think there will be people who look at the Australian example. You can find lots of right-wing commentators on Twitter who want to send different signals about different courses here, and they'll look at Australia and think there's a lesson there, but I'm not completely sure there is a lesson there for us. I don't think it would massively affect student choice. I think it puts fee levels into constant political play, and it's not absolutely clear. As I say, when serious reviews have looked at the question, they've nearly always come out against it. The Brown report did like floating fee levels, but most of the other reports have been against them.
Ellen, from what Debbie is talking about this policy, do you think it reflects what you know and your work you've done about the global trends of student demand?
Yeah, I mean, I think listening to Debbie and Nick, what you were saying, I think it is, you know, it's really important that we look globally and we look at what's going on. I think you're absolutely right about in between Australia and England in particular. And I think if we look more globally, some of the elements of this, I think, do compare to what we've seen in terms of, if indeed it does do this, the kind of drive for more flexible learning, for more this big emphasis on the micro credentials. I mean, the interesting thing about the Australian fee structure model as well, around the fees being at unit level, I noticed that they were, and we talked a lot about looking at in our global studies, the need for a more flexible, continuous learning kind of funding model, as learning will need to be much more lifelong. I saw in some of the commentary, I think the Australian government was saying that, you know, this notion of it being at unit level and the idea of being able to pick different units should encourage more diversity. If that actually led to more kind of interdisciplinary degrees, I think that's something that, again, has been talked of about being, you know, much needed. But I think and also if the ability to credit transfer is easier, it does raise those kind of questions where, definitely from a learner and a student demand, it's not just about the flexible learning in terms of the delivery mode. And we've seen a lot about that in light of COVID-19 around online or blended, but it's actually then about the qualification type or the length. But I think crucially, if this is all about the policy, government policy on measuring degree quality by employment outcomes, then it's all down to what are those qualification types? What are the credentials that are recognised? That's the challenge with short courses as well. What actually then is, you know, recognised with employers? And we know that a degree actually still holds a lot of value. So I think it does, draw on some interesting points. I think overall for me, it kind of raises, similar to our discussion around the graduate outcome survey, that whole question around, you know, if government policy is really about this, you know, the emphasis on measuring degree quality by employment outcomes, And that, you know, what's the role of higher education? Is it just for preparing students for a job or not? But even if we're saying that it was that, well, the qualification you get is one part of that overall process of actually getting a job. And I think there are other angles in the recruitment process as well that studies and have shown in our, you know, global learner survey that we did as well, that there are lots of factors, obviously, on that influence graduates getting a job. Skills and knowledge from university is one, but then things like the interview process is still really dominant. Personality, the culture, fit. So it's not just good enough to get a degree. And I think part of the debate then needs to be looking at what else could or should universities, you know, be doing. Should there be more on the work experience, for example, and extracurricular? So I think it raises lots of interesting questions, but what it actually translates into, I think, remains to be seen.
We've been promised, Debbie, we've been promised action on low value courses now by several universities ministers, but they've never really said what exactly they're going to do. It seems to me, though, that these kind of tools are the sorts of things that they're going to be looking at, right?
Well, I think it's interesting. I mean, picking up on Ellen's point about the kind of the interdisciplinarity and the kind of greater use of short courses and that sort of thing. In some ways, okay, so even if you could pull together an agenda that was able to identify a low-value course on the basis of it being in one subject area, in one university, and having a sufficiently kind of robust basket of data attached to it. So, for example, you were able to demonstrate that not only did students have a horrible time, but then they subsequently went on to, you know, to not get any decent jobs. You know, if those courses existed, I think it would be quite hard to argue that and universities were just kind of letting it happen. It would actually be genuinely hard to argue that the government shouldn't make some kind of intervention. I think, as you say, you know, there's really very little evidence that is true. There are some courses that have worse employment outcomes than others, based on the data that we gather, and that's not the same thing as sort of saying that those courses are essentially low value. So, you know, there's always a caveat. But I think Ellen's point is really important here. There's a wider trend here. You know, clearly there's going to be ongoing demand for, you know, the traditional 3-year undergraduate model, and you know, and all the signs point that way. But you know, increasingly, you know, if you're looking at global education trends, you're talking about people are talking about, you know, the jobs of the future, about the need for people to be kind of broad, have a broad range of kind of intellectual competencies, and of the need to be kind of immersed in professional environments as part of the degree. So that the trend is away from a fixed thing called a course. And so the idea that, you know, and so in many ways, not only is this kind of low value courses agenda quite sort of incoherent, even within the kind of confines of the sort of conservative idea of what a course is, I think in many ways it rather goes against the grain of what the future of higher education is going to look like. So it really, I think, needs an awful lot more thought if the government is not going to sort of, I guess, trip over itself and trip over its own kind of hope to build, you know, a sort of, you know, a model of post-compulsory education that's fit for the 21st century.
I agree with all of that. And I just want to return to one thing that Debbie mentioned in her introduction about Australia, which is these extra places that are part of the package to reflect demography. And of course, there's a couple of ways to work against what politicians might regard as low-value courses. One is to attack the low-value courses, and the other is to make sure any extra places go to the places that you don't think are low-value, the ones you like more. And of course, we're seeing a bit of that here in the UK with these extra student numbers that are being injected in the system despite the new student number cap. And it flags a bigger issue, which is Australia, until very recently, had a demand-driven system where effectively the funding followed the students. England, until the 2020 academic year, also had no student number controls and everything followed the students. And both England and Australia are moving in a sort of more controlling direction. So any extra places are part of a wider set of government decisions. And I personally regret that. I prefer a choice. I prefer a system where students have lots of choice, but, you know, they are given the information about which courses lead to good outcomes and which lead to more challenging outcomes, but it's up to them what they study and where they study. And I think it's regrettable that both Australia and England are moving in a more controlling direction.
Now, Wonky's David Kernan has been diving into new LEO data just out this week.
So what could be better on the hottest day of the year than the LEO data for the 2017-18 tax year? Well, lots of things. A cold beer, a swim in the sea, a walk in a park. But we'll take what we can get. So this is broadly similar to all of the other LEO releases. We've got data on salary for 1, 3 and 5 years after graduation. as with all of these things, we know with Leo there is a set number of significant variables that need to be controlled for, and we don't get them. So we are split by subject, by provider, and by sex. We don't get anything on prior attainment, although they've shoehorned the polar stuff in by institution for that particular year. It's not linked to the graduate in question. And we don't get anything on current region by subject. We have got the current region stuff, the weighted median only by provider, and I have then a plot of that on the site. There's no real surprises in terms of what the data shows us. The interest really with Leo, I would say, is what does it mean post-COVID-19? It is unlikely that the job market for graduates or anybody else will go back to how it was in the 2017-18 tax year. There's already been reasonable questions about how much that kind of historic data can tell us about the likely earnings trajectory of future graduates. And we now get a salary question in graduate outcomes, which is going to be more likely to give us an indication of what graduates are actually earning. Remember, with Leo, we just get a figure for the total year. It doesn't take into account the mode of employment or the amount of months in a year that a graduate is employed. So, same old stuff. We saw Leo used for the first time in policy this week. It's being used to justify the choice of subjects for the additional student numbers in England. It's still not the kind of data you'd want to base policy on, and if it is going to be used as such in future, we need to be clear that we understand its limitations, and we need to push back on these limitations as people are making unreasonable claims based on the data.
Finally, it's the latest HEPI report on the experience of PhD students, and we're lucky enough to have Nick with us this week to tell us all about it. Nick, talk us through your new report.
Well, thank you. It's kind of you to say so, though, of course, all the credit must go to the author, Bethan Cornell, who's a PhD student herself in physics at King's College London. And she's been doing an internship with HEPI. And her report fills a hole, I think, particularly in terms of HEPI's own output, by focusing specifically on the PhD student experience. We and others have done lots of work on the undergraduate student experience, but much less work on the PhD student experience. But the PhD student experience really matters. First of all, there's tens of thousands of PhD students, around 100,000 PhD students at any one time. Secondly, they are the pipeline of talent, both for our own sector, but also for research conducted by companies, by charities, by government. So it really matters. And Bethan's used two very powerful data sets from the Wellcome Trust and Nature to drill down into the student experience for PhD students. And some of the numbers are quite worrying. So PhD students, a lot of them work very unhealthy numbers of hours, 13% to over 60 hours a week. If you divide the typical stipend that a PhD student receives by the average number of hours they work, you get less than the minimum wage. 37% have sought help for anxiety or depression. About half say they've seen, witnessed bullying, and about a quarter say they've been bullied themselves. So I think the overarching message from the report is that PhD students fit a little bit uncomfortably in the Venn diagram between staff on the one side and students on the other. They're treated more like staff in many respects, things like workload, but they're treated more like students in the fact that they don't, you know, have a salary. And Bethan's report ends with a set of really sensible policy recommendations, I think, on being clearer about the number of hours they should be working, better career support, maybe giving them access to a very basic pension, nothing like the USS, just a basic retirement plan, better mentoring, making it easier for them to speak out when they see things going wrong, including having their funders support impartial investigations when necessary. And people who want to hear firsthand from the author, we've got up on the HEPI website a presentation by Bethan summarising her conclusions. And I would like, as I would like with all HEPI reports, this not to be the final word. I would like this to be the start of a conversation and debate that is louder and more detailed than we've had in the past about what PhD students should expect and how they should be treated.
Debbie, you've been reviewing this work on Wonky this week. What jumped out at you?
Well, yeah, I mean, my piece for the site this morning, it basically explores this idea of the experience, because I think a lot of this report rang true for me, and I should caveat that I did my PhD more than 10 years ago now. Painful, but true. I'm really conscious that universities have to do enormous amounts, and will have done enormous amounts. And, there's lots going on just as I was kind of graduating, and more will have happened since to address some of these concerns. But we do, if you triangulate the data in Bethan's report with the postgraduate research experience survey, the thing that really jumped out for me was, I think, a failure of community and culture. So it's not as simple as sort of saying there's a bunch of things that PhD students should expect as standard, because I think in a lot of cases actually universities have kind of nailed that. So that kind of, I guess, slightly what is a reasonable expectation for you as a student of the university, and that should be available to you. And it's more about saying, how do we cope with the fact that doing a PhD is often very challenging? You're coming to a new kind of identity, a new understanding of yourself professionally, that you are working in a research culture that can often have some quite toxic elements in it. And some of the kind of your understanding of your position in that culture can lead you to make assumptions or adopt behaviours that are not kind of healthy for you, and to see that as part of, I guess, a sort of rite of passage. And how do you kind of break down some of those preconceptions and assumptions and patterns that are just so deeply embedded in many cases? And I think that, many university staff would also kind of comfortably say that this is very problematic. So I suppose my kind of take is that there's some things that you can absolutely pinpoint, and Bethan's done a brilliant job of pulling out that data where you can look at it and say, that's a problem. But it's often not as straightforward as saying, and we can put a policy in place to solve it. It's about bringing the whole community together and saying, how do we want to be in a community? What does the kind of really great balance between research excellence and productivity and health and well-being and participation and inclusion look like? And that's, I think, a really challenging thing for universities to get to grips with.
Ellen, do you want to come in on this one?
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was a really interesting and important report. And I think just as Debbie and Nick have said, I think just like, all culture in many different environments, communities and workplaces needs to be continually examined, just as it should in research culture. And there's some of those statistics really did stand out to me about how, isolating it can be, and then the potential knock-on effect is on well-being. I mean, the other point as well around incredibly pressurized and long hours, I was struck on one of the statistics kind of related to that, where nearly three quarters, I think, felt that research culture promoted quantity over quality of output as well. And it felt like that might have been leading to the pressures faced. But I think the thing that I think what Nick said, I just returned to this point around, it really highlighted for me this potential to be caught between being student or being academic staff. And actually are students, but we recognize that PhD students do a lot of support with things like teaching duties, but they're not paid employees as they are in some other countries. And it just made me feel, I'm not sure if this is the right parallel to draw or not, but with some work I've been doing recently with degree apprentices, again, different, but they are caught between this being a student employee, although they're paid, and I've been working and doing some studies with them. It's understanding that identity and being caught between two things can be quite tricky. And I think there was also a point made in the report around, in terms of policy and change and what might be done, there may also be a risk that PhD students are falling between, now that we've split out the two ministers, the Minister of Universities and the Minister for Research, Innovation and Science. That could be problematic as well. But overall, I think it's just really, really important. And I mean, doctoral research and PhD students, they're vital to the pipeline of talent, expertise in our country. No more so have we seen that than now, the critical role of researchers in this pandemic. So needs to be taken very seriously.
I think that's all correct. And of course, the report shines a spotlight on lots of problems. And the author, has firsthand real life lived experience among her and her colleagues of this. So we should definitely listen very carefully to it. But I don't want to lose sight of the big picture. Just like being an undergraduate can be tough and challenging, but when you emerge from the other end, your life chances are hugely improved. That also stands true for postgraduate study, including PhD students. And of course, we need our PhD students, as has just been said. And you know, thinking back to some of the other conversations we've been having about graduate outcomes, the outcomes of most PhD students are also fantastic. I suppose the conundrum is, if the experience of PhD students was better and people felt more welcome and doing their PhD was a little bit easier, we might have even more people going through that experience, making use of the PhD loans that are now available, and ultimately, you know, pushing forward the boundaries of knowledge for, you know, society's benefit.
There's something interesting in there, isn't there, in the report about non-academic career options. And you know, the point I make, lots of people go into their PhD thinking they're going to be an academic, and for various reasons, for a whole constellation of reasons, you know, that may not happen. And one of the kind of findings that jumped out at me from the report was something like only 54% of candidates had sort of said that their supervisor was open to a conversation about careers outside academia. And I think there's a question about perhaps, you know, the extent of the responsibility of supervisors to have those conversations, but also I think I think moves our foot in this space that you know should absolutely be encouraged to understand the contribution of PhDs outside academia, you know, and why it really really matters, that, you know, why it's really valuable if you've got someone with a PhD in your organisation. And there's a bit of a kind of stigma I think sometimes about in non-research focused jobs of people with PhDs, because the expectation is that they will be very narrow, that they'll be very kind of precise and detailed, and they won't necessarily be kind of able for the sort of the cut and thrust of the, you know, the professional world, and it's, you know, I hope that's not true of me. It's certainly not true of other people with PhDs that I have known, and I think the data doesn't bear it out. So it's you know, I think more of a spotlight needs to be shone on those sorts of career trajectories.
Yes, and some of the most interesting conversations that Bethan and I had when she was putting the report together were on that point. And in fact, some of the most interesting conversations I had with David Willett when I was a special advisor were on this point. We used to wrestle with the argument that, you know, is a leaky, what's called the leaky pipeline, where PhD students spin out from academia and go and work elsewhere, a good thing or a bad thing? You know, it's a really interesting question. You know, there are people who blame the last financial crisis on physics PhD students going and working in the city and designing uber complicated products, the financial products that people didn't understand, but which is a negative way of looking at it. But I think in general, society and companies and charities and public sector all benefit, you know, when PhD students, former PhD students, people with doctorates, are working in those fields too. So I think we just need more PhD students. That's my conclusion.
So that's about it for this week. Remember to delve deeper into anything we discussed today. You'll find links in the show notes. Don't forget, you can subscribe to the podcast automatically. Just search for The Wonky Show wherever you listen to your podcasts, or find the feed you need on wonky.com/podcast. And if you fancy appearing as a guest on The Wonky Show, drop us an email on team@wonky.com and we'll be in touch. So thanks to Ellen, Nick and Debbie and everyone at Team Wonky for making it happen behind the scenes. And until next week, stay wonky.